There were sounds around the flat again that night. Sometimes they came as far as my door, and I sat, listening to them move about on the landing. After they grew silent, I retrieved my books from the cupboard and studied what I should do to protect myself. I prepared circles of defense against them and filled them with spells carefully recited and drawn, but I had no confidence in them. Next morning, I reached a snap decision. Harriet had gone up to St. Andrews for a few days with Ian's parents. I would go to St. Andrews and look for her. She would know what to do. St. Andrews is a very small town, and I reckoned that I could call on all the hotels there in a single afternoon. Just as I was leaving the flat, I noticed the copy of Hardy's Desperate Remedies that I'd bought for Harriet, lying on the table where I'd left it, still in its wrapper. Picking the book up, I slipped it into my coat pocket. It did not prove as difficult to find Harriet as I had feared. I remembered that she had once mentioned that her father-in-law was keen on golf, and it occurred to me that he would most probably have chosen a hotel near one of the courses. I found them at Rusick's, right alongside the 18th fairway of the old course, in the dining room, having lunch. Harriet made her apologies, and we went together to the lounge. "I had to come," I said. I told her all about my interview with Inspector Cameron and the objects in Katrina's desecrated grave. "Why didn't you tell him about Milne?" she asked. "What would have been the point? I have no real evidence, nothing that would stand up in court." "But we know he's behind all this." "I'm certain of it, but I think we have to go about this in our own way. I'd like you to come back to Edinburgh. If you have friends there who might be able to help, we should be seeing them now." "You're right," she said. "We have to do this together. Give me a few minutes with them. I'll do my best to explain." "By the way," I handed her the Hardy, "I forgot to give you this." She smiled. "I hope my mother-in-law doesn't see you giving me presents." The string had been tied tightly. She undid it carefully, undoing the knot and rolling up the string as it came free. She peeled off the wrapping and examined the old book. "What is this?" she asked. She was shaking with anger. "I don't think this is funny, Andrew. Not one bit. Whatever it is you're playing at, I don't want to know. But if you want my advice, I think you're sick. You don't need me. You need to see a doctor." She flung the book to the floor, and then turned and ran to the door, stunned. I picked up the book and turned to the title page. It was there in black and white. The same title that I had seen all that time ago in the library of the Fraternity of the Old Path. Matrix Aeternitatis. With a hand that trembled, I turned back the page and looked at the flyleaf. There, unchanged, was the same faded and illegible inscription that had been in the copy I had burned. I remembered the words of the old bookseller as he handed the parcel to me, words I had thought a little odd at the time. "This was the book you wanted, wasn't it?" If I had had my wits about me, I would have guessed what he was up to, but I'd answered, "Yes, it was," and now it belonged to me by right. I knew there was only one way to get rid of it now. The book had to be given back to the old man in person, and he had to be persuaded to take it from me of his own volition, just as I had taken it from him. My only hope of achieving that lay in tricking him in the same way he had tricked me. The moment I arrived back in Edinburgh, I got my boxes of books out of the cupboard. I dumped them on the floor and set aside two which contained spells for protection against evil forces. I thought I might need them before the night was through. Sorting through the others, I found one of almost identical dimensions to the Matrix Aeternitatis. Carefully removing its cover, I glued it round the older volume. Then I placed it at the bottom of a large cardboard box, stacked all the other books on top, and set off for the old bookseller's. Staggering down the street with the box in both arms, I finally reached the cul-de-sac. I put down the box and looked in both directions. Where the bookshop had been was now just an empty shell. The door was boarded over, and when I pressed my face against the window, I could see nothing but empty shelves and what looked like litter. It was as though no one had done business there in years. On an impulse, I rifled through the box until I had found the disguised copy of The Matrix. Then I went round to the rear alley that served the cul-de-sac. Finding the back entrance to the shop was a simple matter of counting from the end. Breaking open the door itself proved more difficult, but a window next to it had already been smashed. I slipped my hand inside and found a catch, and moments later I was crawling through. I found myself in a large room lined with empty shelves, the back room, presumably, where my vanished bookseller kept his better stock. The curtain that had been there on my first visit, separating the front of the shop from the rear, still hung in its place, grey and threadbare, but now the floor was white with a carpet of dust. No one had been here in a very long time, and I knew that I had made a mistake in coming, that something was very wrong. As I stood there, perfectly still, I became aware that a low sound had started in the other room. The sound grew a little at a time, until, in a moment of horrified recognition, I realized what it was. Someone was playing a violin, the Largo from Bach's Concerto for Two Violins in D Minor. No, not someone. Katrina. How did I know? Because I had heard her play that piece time and time again until I could anticipate the exact fingering, the pauses, the fractional errors that she always strove to eliminate. The playing stopped. I kept my eyes fixed on the curtain separating the front from the rear. There was a foul silence throughout the building. The curtain rippled suddenly as though a current of air had passed through it and then grew still again. I expected at any moment to see Katrina materialize beside me. A moment later, the air around me filled with an unmistakable perfume. She did not materialize. That is to say, I did not see a figure appear. But out of the darkness, I felt something touch my cheek. It was a hand, the skin soft and warm, though I could see nothing. The hand continued to caress my face. I stood there, wretched, wanting to scream, to pull away, to run. And then she stepped closer, and her arms were round me, pulling me to her, embracing me, her lips kissing my cheeks, my nose, my forehead, and at last my lips. It was Katrina. Not a simulacrum, not a doppelganger. I could not mistake the movements of her hands, the teasing and surrender of her lips. I might almost have succumbed, might have given in to the embrace and put my own arms round her. Dear God, I came so very close to that. Reason screamed at me to run. My eyes told me there was nothing there, that whatever it was not Katrina. But my body, so unexpectedly caressed, had its own responses. It came to me that I had once read in one of the books lent to me by Duncan that if a succubus came to a man, he should turn to it and ask its name. I pulled my lips away from the mouth that was kissing mine. "What is your name?" I asked. "What is your name?" The air that had been so sweetly perfumed changed suddenly, and I started coughing as though ashes newly burned had been pressed against my face. Instead of lips, I felt a tongue licking my skin. Not a human tongue, but longer and rougher to the touch. I turned and ran for the door. Behind me, a voice started calling. Katrina's voice. "Andrew, come back. It's me. I need you. Andrew." I carried on running, and did not stop until I had reached the alleyway. The Matrix Aeternitatis was still in my coat pocket. Since I could not now rid myself of that hateful book, I decided to look at it more closely and to see if I could determine why it had been forced on me and why its presence seemed to bring such horrors in its wake. When I got home, I reread the short prologue by the English translator Nicholas Oakley, but nothing shed any light on my dilemma. Oakley did not, in fact, seem to know much about either the book or its author beyond their evil reputation, and as I read his translation, it gradually became apparent to me that he had worked not from the original Arabic, but from the Latin, and that the Latin itself was by no means always faithful to the original. Confused by these misreadings and the uncertainty they provoked in me, I determined to try my hand at the original. I discovered two things straight away: the author's identity and the period when he had lived. Both the Latinizer and Oakley called him Ave Metus, but in the exordium to the Arabic version, the author had written out his name in full, together with that of his father, as was the custom. Wamin Bad Achada Yakul Al Abd Al Fani. To begin, thus says this evanescent servant, Abu Ahmad Abdallah ibn Suleiman Al Fazi Al Mahribi. Abu Ahmad Abdallah, the son of Solomon, the man from Fez, the Moroccan. I leafed to the back of the Faraid, the dictionary of classical Arabic I had used while in Morocco. During my sessions with Sheikh Ahmad, I had sometimes jotted down notes on the blank pages at the back. In the course of one lesson, he had explained to me something of his lineage. I had written the details down dutifully without giving them real attention. Now I looked at them more closely. He was, he had said, born Ahmad, the son of Abdallah. That meant that his father would have been called Abu Ahmad Abdallah, the father of Ahmad Abdallah. I looked at my notes again. Ahmad's grandfather had been called Suleiman, his great-grandfather Abd al-Razul, and his great-great-grandfather Umar. I picked up the matrix again and leafed through the first few pages. There, on the third page, was what I was looking for. I learned these things from my father, who learned them in turn from his father, Suleiman. And Suleiman had them from his father, Abd al-Razul, who had them from his father, Umar. It did not seem possible that this, a book whose English translation had been published in 1598, could have been written by the father of a man I had spoken to only a few months earlier. But when had the author of The Matrix himself lived? I turned at once to the colophon, a brief passage at the end of a text where the author would give brief details of the date when he had completed his task, or the scribe the day he ended the labour of transcription. I was not disappointed. Sheikh Abu Ahmad had followed convention to the letter. Completed by the hand of this wretched servant in the imperial city of Fez on the fifth day of Rabi al-Awwal 585, in the reign of the just and benevolent Caliph, Lord of Spain and Morocco, Sultan Yaqub ibn Yusuf al-Mansur. It could not have been clearer. The matrix had been finished on the 23rd of April, 1189. In it, Abu Ahmad claimed, he had passed on to his eldest son the secret of all secrets, the key to mastery over life and death. Anyone who wished to conquer death should recite the spells and perform the rituals detailed in the text. The purpose of the Matrix Aeternitatis, then, was to teach men a method for attaining everlasting life, not through religion or mysticism or alchemy, but by magic. The book itself was to be the matrix for survival. But by the time I had finished reading, I was certain that there was something more to it than that, and I was reasonably certain what it was: the power to return to life those already dead.